From the Sky News Centre at 6, a mum has been told she'll serve at least 32 years in jail for killing her two daughters because they got in the way of her love life. Louise Porton from Rugby was found guilty yesterday of murdering Lexi, who was 3, and Scarlett, who was 17 months. The judge said the 23-year-old delayed calling an ambulance until she knew they couldn't be resuscitated. One 999 call was played in court.
Ambulance service, is the patient breathing?
No.
They're not breathing?
No.
Okay. And who was it we're talking about?
Lexi, she's 3.
She's 3? Bear with
me.
Okay. So, she's unconscious and she's not breathing.
Engineers are still said to be very concerned about a partially collapsed dam threatening a town in Derbyshire. An RAF Chinook helicopter has been dropping sandbags to try to strengthen the Todbrook Reservoir near Whaley Bridge. The US is blaming Russia for the collapse of a Cold War-era deal to limit their nuclear weapons. It's due to expire in 2021, but the White House says Moscow has been violating it for several years, which it denies. R. Kelly has pleaded not guilty to charges he sexually exploited young women and girls at his concerts. The R&B singer has been denied bail in a courtroom in New York packed with his supporters. That's the latest. I'm Kit
Bradshaw.
What's
good, people? On BCFM 93.2.
BCFM 93.2 is proud to...
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Independent Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. So after the 7 o'clock news, worse than Honduras, Trump's verdict on the city of Baltimore. He says the city's corrupt, but mayor of the Democrat-run city, Elijah Cummings, he says it's just more evidence the president's a racist. And the Israeli army cadets are released in Cyprus after accusation they gang raped a British girl. Apparently it was her fault. And in a Mexican cafe, Israeli mafia shootings leave 2 dead. The invasion of Afghanistan back in 2001 still going strong. Only trouble is the occupying NATO forces are killing more civilians than the so-called indigenous enemy, the Taliban. Is it time to go home, or is the West's continuing presence there just a rather thin excuse for colonialism and intimidation of Russia and Iran next door? And Javad Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, is personally sanctioned by the US. Will it make any difference if it is? And when will the Grace 1 tanker be released? In Gibraltar, evidence this week that the state of Gibraltar changed the law the day before the tanker was boarded in international waters to make the piracy legal, at least under Gibraltar's law. Plus, the president of Israel, who is he? Reuven Rivlin, and what does he think about changing the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 16 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 24 Celsius. Light cloud, but thundery showers, possibly on Sunday. Next week, highs around 22, sunny spells, but also plenty of showers next week. Next weekend, that's the 10th and 11th of August, highs of 22, sunshine and showers. Sounds like pretty much the same thing from Sunday onwards, doesn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, joining me to review this week's news is Independent Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey. He was on this show a month or so ago. Then he was a Conservative councillor. Now he's not. But first, before all that, joining me on the line is Mark Watts, the freelance journalist who's been covering a lot of the child abuse scandal. Mark, can you hear me, first of all?
I can.
Could you just tell us what you've been doing over the last couple of years following the inquiry and now this specific case?
As the editor of Exeru, and I suppose we led the charge in publishing stories about allegations concerning VIPs and child sexual abuse. And I suppose our reporting led to the setting up of, which has various strands, Westminster, as it were, being one of them, wrote about somebody who was known by the name of Nick, who went on trial himself over the past 3 months or so. He was charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice and with making a fraudulent compensation claim. And a couple of weeks ago now, he was convicted on all counts and was sentenced just over a week ago to 18 years in prison.
With the Nick conviction, there's been a lot of talk about this over the last couple of weeks, actually. I think it was Monday before last, the sentence was announced, or the conviction was announced, and then last Friday, the sentencing. What do you think, how sound was this case? Because I know there was quite a lot that the jury were not allowed to hear by the judge.
Yes, well, I do have real concerns about the way the trial ran, which leads, in my view, to the convictions being essentially unsafe convictions. My concern falls into two broad camps, judicial rulings on the one hand and material relating to the evidence on the other. On rulings, there was a ruling before the trial started that the prosecution was going to be allowed to tell the jury about the fact that the defendant, Carl Beach, had pleaded guilty earlier this year in a separate case to downloading and possession of indecent images of children. Now, normally, as I'm sure you're aware, you cannot tell a jury about any previous convictions because of the risk of prejudicing them. And my view was that that ruling was highly prejudicial, and quite frankly, it didn't really matter what evidence would surface in the case. The jury was always going to convict him because they'd see it through the prism of his being someone who had downloaded indecent images. Terrible as that is, or, you know, absolutely heinous crime that he definitely did commit by downloading those images and on charge of voyeurism. I believe that the jury shouldn't have been aware of that and should have assessed the evidence of attempting to pervert the course of justice on that evidence alone, and there shouldn't have been the prejudicial point about the previous convictions. Separate to that, there was a ruling about evidence relating to Harvey Proctor. There'd been limited disclosure very late in the day to the defence by the prosecution, which related to the police investigation into Harvey Proctor in the 1980s, around 86, 87, and in relation to the property search that was carried out under Operation Midland, i.e. the investigation into Nick's allegations, the property search carried out on Harvey Proctor's home in March 2015. And the defence wanted two things. They wanted further disclosure on this material, because, as I say, they had limited disclosure. And they also wanted to be able to cross-examine Harvey Proctor about it, about these two elements. And basically, the judge said no to both. So I think those rulings are critical to the way in which the trial was shaped. But I also think that there were some problems with the evidence. We know that, and we certainly knew at Exeru, that the Met considered Nick, Carl Beach, to have been a credible witness, and we knew that well before they publicly said so. But what the trial never heard was the basis for that assessment by the Met officers on the case. You know, it's been widely talked about, there's been this widespread assumption that the Met simply automatically believed their witness because that's the police policy. But in fact, that's not true. I mean, it is the police policy, and that is true. What isn't true is that that is why the officers believed him. There's more to it than that, and the trial didn't hear about that. And the other thing that the trial didn't hear anything about was any insight into the possible effects of childhood trauma. Now, the prosecution attempted to, well, their speculative case was that here we have someone who is interested in downloading indecent images, and that was why, by their account, he made up all this stuff about abuse by VIPs. However, in my view, there is clear evidence that he certainly was sexually abused in his childhood, putting aside the issue as to who by, he certainly was sexually abused in his childhood, and that, of course, the traumatic effects of that. We simply heard no evidence as to how that can manifest itself, for example, in how such a person gives an account of what happened to them, and indeed in relation to behaviours that can follow on from that past. So I think the trial was very troubling in the way in which it was conducted, and I think it means that the end result cannot be relied on.
So does that mean, do you think, Mark, that there may be an appeal after this?
Yes, I mean, it is possible, and my understanding is that that is something that the legal team on behalf of Carl Beach are looking into, but they haven't made a definite decision on that, and I suppose they don't have to. My understanding is that you have 28 days from the point of the conviction, which, as you said, was the Monday before last. I think I've got that right. 28 days from then if you want to appeal against the conviction, or 28 days from the sentencing if you want to appeal solely against the sentencing. And I suppose the areas of appeal that I certainly think should be advanced will be over the rulings. The refusal to force a greater disclosure on what Operation Midland found and on what other investigations found into allegations against various VIPs, and the rulings that shaped this case in terms of blocking cross-examination over certain matters of Harvey Proctor, and the initial ruling about allowing the jury to know all about the previous convictions that Carl Beach had.
So, I mean, there's a lot to take in there, but I think maybe one of the most striking things about this case is, why were the jury not allowed to hear why the Metropolitan Police decided, after having a look at Nick's evidence, or Carl Beach's evidence, that actually that there was definitely something to it? I mean, that was their conclusion, and it seems strange that the court would not be, that would not be explained to the court.
I think there are two elements to that. I mean, one, I think from the defence point of view, they kind of hoped that that would become clear if there'd been full disclosure on material gathered by Operation Midland. But because it's clear they only had, well, they said in court they had very limited disclosure. I did tweet the figures at the time. I think one of the witnesses referred to how much material there was and how much material had been disclosed. It was a tiny proportion of the Operation Midland material that was actually disclosed to the defence. So if they'd had full disclosure, then the defence would think that it would become apparent from that why it was that the police officers took him to be so credible, and indeed infamously. Of course, the police actually said publicly in the early stages of the investigation that they regarded him to be a credible and true witness.
Is it simple when in these cases like this that really this is about one lawyer against another, and about how good and clever and well-funded one legal team is than the other one? Because I would imagine that Carl Beach doesn't have quite as much clout and money as some of the people he's up against.
Yes, I mean, I think it's sense there's an element of truth in that for all cases. I mean, anybody who is being tried on a charge is up against the resources of the state, and they're reliant on their own resources and with perhaps some assistance from the state, of course, in the form of legal aid, but it's not really comparable. And I suppose that battle is a little bit more equal if you have significant resources yourself. So I think that's a point that can be made in any case. I think here the kind of disparity of arms was perhaps not so much about resource, though, as access to information. As I say, the defence team were often acting in the dark. I remember, let me give you a little example of how that manifested itself. There was a reference to a schedule of items that were seized from Harvey Proctor's home by Operation Midland in March 2015, and one was a reference to a notepad that was seized relating to child sexual abuse, but he wasn't specified what exactly it was. And it was just a list of items. Of course, the defence wanted the items themselves so they could assess, you know, what was there. And the prosecution actually stood up and said, well, we can't give you these items, even if we wanted to, because we don't have them anymore. We gave it all back to him. And the judge, before he made his ruling on this specific point, this specific application, did say that, he made his point that, well, I'm completely in the dark. You're in the dark, referring to the defence team. I'm in the dark, and I've got to make a decision, or worse to that effect. And there was a sense remark on some of this evidence. There was also a reference to indecent photographs, which the court assumed were legal, bearing in mind no legal action, no criminal action carried on. There was a particular officer who had seized all these items, and the judge said, perhaps we ought to have this officer back to tell us more about all this, but it never happened. So there was this, there were these great black holes in the midst of the trial.
What about the sentence of 18 months? I mean, this is in some of the commentary, years. That this is actually likely to have a chilling effect on any survivors of child sexual abuse thinking of coming forward, because, and also, of course, on potentially on the reporting of this sort of thing as well.
Well, several points there. I mean, first of all, it is possible for attempting to further the course of justice to get a life sentence. So, in one sense, it could have been worse. But in another sense, I think if you think about sentencing practice, I mean, I think, you know, it's a very heavy sentence, 18 years in total. That's the prison sentence. That's the sentence he received, although he will serve half of that in jail and will be released on licence unless something else changes, but that would be the normal course of events. In terms of deterrence, I mean, I do think that, I mean, clearly, if you're guilty of something like this, then you know, you deserve to be convicted and deserve to go to jail for it. The question comes down to whether you're guilty of it or not. And I think, you know, I think one of the things one has to remember is that anybody who comes forward to make claims of sexual abuse, almost of any type, but certainly from childhood in particular, it has such a damaging effect on such a person that the way in which they behave and the way in which they recount their experiences do not fall into neat boxes in a way that people who are not familiar with this area perhaps realise. Now, the judge did make standard warnings about not falling into stereotypes, but I'm afraid I think the whole case really shows that the criminal justice system is ill-equipped to handle evidence from people who claim to be victims of serious sexual abuse in their childhood. Because I think the other point I was trying to remember earlier that is crucial is we didn't hear any testimony relating to the possible effects of childhood trauma. You know, there was no insight into whether this person who was in the dock, whether he was someone who displayed symptoms of actually having suffered child sexual abuse or not, putting aside the issue of who by, but whether he, you know, whether he was displaying those traumatic effects or whether it was all put on, as of course the prosecution was seeking to establish.
And one of the cases that springs to mind after this, Mark, is the case of Gordon Anglesey. He was someone who was completely exonerated, as in some ways Harvey Proctor could said to have been, of any kind of hints of child sexual abuse. And then afterwards it was discovered actually he had been a paedophile, even though he was a police superintendent. So these cases do have a habit of sometimes going one way and the other. I wonder whether you think that we've heard the last from Nick or Carl Beach.
Well, I think you really, your point there goes to the issue of basically the criminal justice system is ill-equipped to get to the truth or to assess, you know, whether someone coming forward to make allegations of sexual abuse, particularly child sexual abuse, they're very ill-equipped to handle it. And I suppose the case of Gordon Anglesey illustrates that, because of course one civil court one time basically concluded that the witnesses were lying and that he was not a sexual abuser of children or had not been. And then of course many years later a criminal case came to the precise opposite conclusion. So I think the one thing you can be sure of is that the criminal justice system was wrong on at least one of those occasions.
So finally, do you think we're seeing with the precedent set in these cases and new legal rulings and even new legislation a slow change in the law with relating to child sexual abuse and whether you think that it's moving in the right direction or not?
Well, I suppose one of the things that will happen is there'll be a concerted effort to sort of exploit this case to drum to increase the pressure to stop naming those accused, for example, those arrested, or even I think through to the point of being charged. And I think what that points to is pressure for even greater secrecy within the criminal justice system in Britain than we already have, which I certainly do not think is the answer. We do not need greater secrecy in our already overly secretive culture.
Mark, where can people follow your work? I know you've got a, I think it's www.foiacentre.com website, but where's the best place to follow what you're doing?
Well, I mean, it's probably best to follow me on Twitter at markwatts_1, and if you look through there, you'll see the link to quite a detailed article that I wrote about that crucial ruling over the evidence relating to Harvey Proctor, a full playing out of what was said in court about the evidence that the prosecution had disclosed the defence, albeit in a limited form, what it was they were asking for. And I will, of course, inevitably be returning to the subject.
Okay, Mark Watts, website is www.foiacentre.com, and he's on Twitter at Mark Watts. And I'll put a link up to that article Mark's just mentioned there. Its headline is Harvey Proctor Had Sexual Interest in Young Boys. Judge in Nick Trial Heard Without the Jury, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Mark Watts, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I've not been following it as closely as Mark has, obviously, but it's quite clear. We had, do you remember we had, was it, it was a Detective Sergeant Wedger, wasn't it, from the Metropolitan Police?
Oh, John Wedger, yeah.
John Wedger, and he was telling us how difficult it was to prosecute these kinds of cases.
He was just a DC, Detective
Sergeant. A DC, right, yeah.
And he was saying that as he was starting to get close to prosecutions, he was basically told to lay off, and in fact, had threats to take his home away from him.
Well, eventually drummed out of the police, as you know, but he was saying that, and one of the points he made was that a lot of the kids that are abused through the, you know, they basically go to children's homes and places like that, they're very vulnerable, and of course they're in the power of the state, really. And, of course, you know, powerful people are able to get access to them, like the Kinkora Boys Home scandal in Northern Ireland, where MI5 were implicated in what they were doing there. And then when they come, in later life, they tend to have problems. They're alcoholics, drug addicts, they download child pornography. And, of course, their characters can be blackened very easily. And it's very difficult then for them to, you know, for them to be credible witnesses in front of respectable juries.
I mean, we had an example a few years ago on this program. If you want to go through our archives, you'll find it. It's a guy called Jim Gamble, who was a computer expert. He was an expert witness, and he was prosecuted, or there was an attempt to prosecute him by, I believe, Avon and Somerset Police, where Colin Port was the chief constable, for having images of child sexual abuse, which, of course, is a criminal offence. But the thing is, he had them to analyse for the courts. And they were trying to prosecute him as if he was himself a paedophile. So there's quite a lot of nasty stuff goes on in these cases, or can do.
Well, indeed.
Well, I'm also joined by Tony Carey. Sorry to drop you in the deep end with this rather nasty national story, Tony. But what do you make of what you've just heard? And this, just the general, I suppose the main thing is, what is the effect of this? This is what bothers me, is that those who either themselves have been abused or know people who've been abused may think twice about going to the police now when they've seen an 18-year sentence handed down to
this guy. That's exactly the point, that as soon as I saw the outcome of the court case, that's the immediate reaction I got. And also, I often wonder if the characters who were accused of these assaults and subsequently been found not guilty were ordinary members of society, whether in fact it would have been 18 years or whether it had been a much lesser degree. I think that the characters, the status of the characters has resulted in Carl Beach being imprisoned for a much longer period of time than would have happened if it had been you or I who had been accused.
Martin, it does seem to have been tainted, this whole scandal, by the fact that the implications of very rich and powerful people being involved.
Well, I think I mentioned Kinkora Boys Home earlier, and it's a big scandal in Northern Ireland because it's all well known. They basically, MI5, were using it as a honey trap, so various political figures would go in there, have sex with underage boys, they'd be photographed, and then they were blackmailed politically. And I think, I'm afraid, that that's the sort of thing that's been going on, not just in Northern Ireland. And, of course, it's been there's a use of paedophilia as a form of political blackmail on senior politicians and others. Yeah, so it's a strategy that's pursued by intelligence services, and we're sniffing around the edge of it here.
And yet, only yesterday or the day before, maybe, we suddenly hear now that Nottinghamshire Council have suddenly realised that up to 350 children have been being abused on a regular basis, maybe up for the last 4 or 5 decades. Yeah. One wonders where people... you know, how deep their heads must be in the sand not to realise that this sort of thing goes on, and they should be looking so closely. And if, I mean, I'm sure it isn't, but if such a thing were to be found happening in Bristol, I would be mortified. And I really think that would be the one occasion, one thing that would make me want to leave my city if something like that was going on. Young people deserve every protection we can give them.
Well, they certainly do. And one of the shocking things Mark was talking about there is just a failure of the justice system. So this is just the justice system supposedly crunching around, a judge looking at all this, and then an unsound verdict coming out where certain important bits of evidence are not being heard. In another case earlier this month, or last month actually, Yusuf Mackey was killed in Manchester. And two boys were found not guilty over a fatal stabbing of him. Now, I thought we were trying to do something about knife crime. Yusuf Mackey was a 17-year-old grammar school graduate in Manchester, and he was stabbed in the heart. But apparently it's not murder. Two boys have been found guilty over the death of... This is back in... Just looking for the date on here. That's the 12th of July. Of the death of Manchester Grammar School pupil Yusuf Mackey. As a jury returned their verdicts at Manchester Crown Court, Yusuf's father was heard to shout from the public gallery, "Where's the justice for my son?" The A-level student, 17, from Burnage in Manchester, passed away in hospital in March 2019 after he was stabbed in the chest on Gorse Bank Road in Hale Barnes. Two youths, boys aged 17 who cannot be named for legal reasons, have been on trial for almost a month facing several charges in connection with his death, but they found the court found that they were not guilty of murder, or the guy that actually stabbed him wasn't guilty of murder. It was all in self-defense. And so this boy A, who can't be named, also 17 years of age, is going to be serving 8 months, I believe, of a 16-month sentence, and then he's out after stabbing someone in the chest and killing them. That apparently is no longer murder in this country. But to add insult to injury, actually in the courtroom, boy A went into the toilets and filmed himself doing stabbing motions, posted it on the internet, and then that was sent to the family of the victim. So it does seem as if the courts are not really doing their job, Martin.
Well, I mean, the problem with all of these things is each case is individual. I don't know anything about that case apart from what you've just told me. And that's not to do with VIP paedophilia, it's to do with stabbings, a totally different topic. I really don't know what happened there. Sound right.
Yusuf Mackey's dad collapsed in court after the boy was cleared of his murder. I can't call him a murderer because he wasn't accused in court, or wasn't found guilty in court of being a murderer. Then went and took the mickey by going sending out triumphal videos about how he's got off.
Well, it doesn't sound right, does it? But then there are miscarriages of justice in the best systems.
Anyway,
ours isn't the best, is it?
Talking of miscarriages of justice, Tony Carey, you used to be a Conservative councillor in Bristol here, and you're a Brislington East councillor, but now you've left the Conservative. In their hour of greatest need, you have left the Conservative Party. How did that happen?
Well, I was very disenchanted with the way that the last Prime Minister was dealing with the B issue, Brexit. I really thought she was fumbling around, and despite being, I'm sure, a totally honest and open person.
Really?
She's just totally incapable of holding her own party together. Now, in Bristol, at the City Council, we endeavour to put on a united front. We hold our debates, and I think I mentioned this on this programme before, we hold our debates in our committee rooms, and then when we go out to council, then we put on a united front because we have made our decision as a group. And if you don't like that idea, then you either work harder at putting your case over in the future, or you leave. It wasn't so much at all about decisions we have made in the group that made me jump ship. It was purely the hierarchy up in Westminster. When Sajid Javid was eliminated from the race, that for me was the final straw, because in my humble opinion, what we have done, or what the Conservative Party have done, is go back I don't know how many years. We've not learnt anything over the last decade or more.
But shouldn't you be giving Boris a chance to see if he can make good here? I mean, it's the whole membership of your party that's chosen this, not a few elites at the top of the party.
What made me laugh is, Boris would appear, maybe I'm being biased here, but to be perhaps the most morally corrupt of all the candidates. We were talking earlier on about anyone who believed the Brexit promise of so many million pounds per week for the NHS was a fool. However, here we are, week one, and Boris is still shouting magic numbers of how he's going to spend and do this and do that and do the other. Where is this coming from?
When Boris's new golden age starts to bloom here in Britain, will you come crawling back to the Conservative Party?
Put my hands up and I will say I was wrong. I don't know if I can go back to the Conservative Party, but people know me as a conservative style of character. I'm not going to go leaping in and leaping out. This decision cost me a lot of sleepless nights, many sleepless nights. When I handed in my resignation, I was asked to sit on it and think again. And I did for 36 hours. And in those 36 hours, I didn't sleep a wink, because I believe I have made the right decision. I can serve my community of Brissington East much, much better as an independent, without any call upon having to think about whether it's Conservative policy or not. I can go around to those houses now and say, look, here I am, this is me. If you've got a problem, tell me about it now. And so far, no one has sent me an email or a message of any description that isn't anything but supportive. So I believe I have done the right thing.
Well, what happens though next year in the local elections? You'll be standing as an independent against the might of the Conservative ticket, because for most people who are standing as councillors, it's really the people who vote for them vote for the party, not them as a specific individual, don't they?
I think they do. But I'll tell you a little funny story. Now, in as much as the Conservative group in Bristol sent me a list of my members in my ward, all six of them. I wrote to every one of them, and two wrote back and said that they thanked me for their letter, but couldn't help me in any way, shape or form, as they were too infirm. Quite right, because I know them both. Two didn't write back at all, and the other two wrote back and said, will you please hurry up and sort out Brexit? And I thought, well, for crying out loud, the specific question was, what can I do for you at council? And they came back and told me to sort out Brexit. So really, those six people really I had no support in any way, shape or form. I've been running a one-man campaign. It's been costing me in the region of £500 a year to run a one-man campaign, but to an organisation I'm paying money to. So I thought, well, I'm going to save this £500 a year. I'm going to use it to promote. Well, if the day came I had my own political party, it would be called 4-4 Bristol. Figure 4-4 Brissington. Beg your pardon. 4-4 Brissington. Because there are four councillors in Greater Brissington, and in an ideal world, we would have all four councillors for Brissington, for Greater Brissington, from our own community, and they would not be tied to political dogma.
Martin, this has actually been a success in the city with the mayor, hasn't it, with George Ferguson deciding to stand as an independent. Do you think there's a place for that as people start to hemorrhage support for both Conservative and Labour? There seems to be, for example, in the Radnorshire by-election, Labour nearly lost their deposit. The Brexit Party ate right into the Conservative vote. And surely the voters are thinking, well, actually, the old system of Labour or Tory is out the window now. We want new parties and we want independents like Tony here, or George Ferguson, as he managed to get in as mayor.
Well, in actual fact, in rural Britain, independents are very powerful. It's because Bristol's a city and we're connected to the national scene that you have this strong party allegiance. But, you know, and of course independents are often independently wealthy. You know, when people say they're independents, they've still got views, and they fit. And I'm not saying that you're independently wealthy, because I know you're not. I'm just saying that, you know, being an independent just means you're not part of the main structure, but you're still going to have your views. You're still going to fit somewhere in the spectrum, aren't you? And that's inevitable.
Yes. Marvin said this to me, or said, yes, it was to me, at a meeting, that he didn't like the independent politicians because they only made money for themselves. Yeah, right. Okay, Marvin, you tell me how I'm going to hardly even live on the £12,000 a year I am paid, or my allowance is as being a councillor. From that, I will now have to put all my own printing. I won't get any discount by having a party printer. Everything I'm going to do now, I'm paying for out of my pocket.
I thought that actually being a member of a mainstream party meant that you were on this sort of career ticket onto being an MP, and actually might be a way to make money rather than as an independent councillor. I can't think of any sort of independent councillors who've made their fortune being an independent councillor.
No.
Can you?
Well, I don't need to, because I'm fully retired. I don't need to work. When I was a councillor before and working, it cost me a fortune, in as much that I lost a day's pay to attend a meeting, and yet for that day's pay, maybe £75, £100, whatever it was back in those days, I was paid £25. At the end of the first 12 months, my wife went ballistic about how much money I had lost by being a councillor and representing my community. That doesn't matter now. I'm living on my pension. This money that I'm getting from the council is that's what allows me to go out and do everything I possibly can do for my community, for our community.
I'm still wondering, actually, what Marvin's personal wealth is, because if you remember, we had the Panama Papers just before he was elected, and I asked him about that at Hustings, which he was the last person who had agreed to come, and he only came because everyone else was coming.
Yeah.
And I asked him the question, Marvin Rees, what's your personal private wealth? And he said, oh, I'll only tell you if you tell me yours, Tony. And I said, well, it's just about £3,000. And then he refused to tell us what his personal wealth was. So it was a little bit of an awkward situation. But, I mean, Martin, don't you think some people are just in it for the money, politics, the careers?
In Norway, where all those young people were killed by the extremists a few years ago,
Anders,
the
Labour
Party,
yeah.
Labour Party summer camp. And in other Scandinavian countries, everybody's income tax returns are public. So you can, if you're having an argument with somebody, you can say, well, I'm going to look at your income tax returns. Straight away, you know how wealthy everybody else is. And in actual fact, as an economist, I would say that knowing how much money somebody's got or their family has got is relevant to what they're saying. People saying it's their private business. I mean, George Ferguson was asked how wealthy he is, and he said, well, it's millions, but I can't tell you how much. Now, that's okay. He's being honest about it in one way. But, you know, there's no doubt about the fact that he's a wealthy guy.
Well, maybe Marvin's in the millions too.
No, Marvin's a public sector person, so it won't be the same level. Compared to ordinary people.
He may have inherited wealth.
No, he hasn't inherited any wealth, Tony.
Right. You know that, do you?
Yes, I do.
For a fact.
Well, if we're going to start talking about people having wealth, then everybody's got to be on the table about it, yeah?
Yes, I agree.
Everybody's got to be honest about their money comes from, if we're going to talk about it.
Well, yes, I agree. But they're not, are they? Certainly
no, not in this country, because in this country, people, you know, it used to be the thing in the aristocracy not to talk about where your money came from, yeah? And not to talk about how much you'd got. Like the whole the joke on the music hall, how much does a Grecian earn? I don't know, because I'm too polite to ask. Yeah. Now in other countries there's a much more robust attitude to this. How much are you actually worth? In Norway, you know. And that's because they had a socialist administration since World War II.
Maybe we should have something similar going on here. Anyway, in the city, I know you're a Brexiteer, Tony. We've got an organisation called the Leavers of Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
And this group is a social group, really, because what they're saying is, many of these Brexiteers, is that actually they get quite a hard time over it. And the fact that they're pro-Brexit, they get bullied. They're worried at work that if they're openly a Brexiteer, that they might lose their jobs, this sort of thing. So it seemed like a good idea to get together. And 2 months ago, they were all brought in, this group, to the Bristol Post. And they were asked all about their group for 2.5 hours. Anyway, I'll let the convener of the of this group, Paul Tanner, tell the story. I spoke to him earlier this week. The article, well, did it appear or not in the Bristol Post?
What about your experience at the Bristol Post? Because I know that you were approached via Mike Norton, the editor, and Kate Wilson there. What happened?
So that,
because I haven't read this article.
Just because it's not come out. So it was a very interesting one, and I think it does say a lot about perceptions of Leave voters. So 7 of us went along, again, quite a mix of people. We ended up talking for 2.5 hours, which was great. The person interviewer was very, very friendly and very interested. And in the conversation, what we largely talked about were concerns with the lack of effective democracy in the EU, how a lot of decision-making is opaque, how, for example, you know, MEPs, what can they actually affect in terms of legislation? You know, legislation doesn't come from the MEPs. It's something that they can pass, but that's about all. So all these real kind of technical elements of how the EU works. And it got into about 1.5 hours into the interview, and the interview actually stopped in a pause of the conversation. No one's mentioned immigration yet. She was genuinely surprised that actually there was quite a level of knowledge of how the EU works, and largely our concerns were with its opaqueness and lack of effective
The fact it doesn't really get discussed that much, the way the EU works, and one wonders whether journalists actually understand how it works. But anyway, so why hasn't it appeared? Have they told you?
No, this was 2 months ago.
Talking about the end of May.
Yeah, and I've been in touch a number of times since. For a while, it was, oh, I'm still planning to write it, da-da-da-da-da. But yeah, it's not come out. So I've made the assumption now that it's not going to.
I mean, it's already become pretty obvious that as we disconnect from Brussels, we're reconnecting with the great American empire, and the US is going to be taking it. It basically means dumbing down the standards. The standards in the US are far worse than we've had with the EU. So isn't this whole thing really a step backwards?
I don't agree with that. I mean, one of the things that was very, the Conservative government was, the May government was very quick to come out with, was that they would actually just take on board a lot of the existing legislation and laws from the EU and just take that into law. I don't believe that British consumers, particularly in farming as well, would welcome that move. At all. I really don't think that.
I mean, surely we've got to be in the sphere of influence of one empire or another. Britain isn't an independent country anymore, is it? We're too small, we're too insignificant. We used to have an empire one day, we haven't got one anymore.
Of course, I know, and I think Britain has always tread an interesting place between the United States and Europe, and I think it will continue to do so. Well, I can understand how people might think this sounds a little bit Little Englander, but there is something about our geography. We're an island on the edge of Europe. We have very, very close links to the United States. Obviously, the language is one of those things as well, and I think that that position will always really keep England in a punching above its weight, to be honest, Britain, beyond its weight.
So that's Paul Tanner from Leavers of Bristol. I'll put a link up to them on our show page. They've got a Facebook group, and there's something called Leavers of Britain. They're on there. But Martin, the main thing here is, this is interesting, isn't it? You've got a whole bunch of people. I think he said 5 or 8 people go along, sit down for 2.5 hours with Kate Wilson at the Bristol Post, bare their souls, talk about everything, and nothing appears in the newspaper. It just seems a little bit peculiar.
Well, I don't really know what happened there. Maybe you need to speak to Kate Wilson.
Well, I have.
And find
I've,
out what did she have to
Kate,
say about it.
I've approached Kate Wilson and got no answer at all. So I would assume that the editor has spiked it for whatever reason. But I mean, what do you make of this, Tony?
No, it sounds like a classic case of not wanting to rock somebody's boat. And these folks come along, like-minded people like myself, with a point of view, with an idea. The people who, you know, the press, just the editors, who really are the people who really make the decisions on all of this, decided, oh, no, well, we won't actual fact cover that. We'll cover a bit more about local football or something like that. again, it's limitations that the media do carry out against, let's say, minority groups. But in Bristol, Brexiteers overall are a minority group. However, in certain areas of Bristol, the more industrial areas, the Brexiteers are the majority.
Interesting. I think it's just censorship at the Bristol Post. That's what it sounds like to me. I mean, it's the simplest solution. Anyway, Boris is supposed to be really in charge. Your favourite person, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
He has taken the Brexit pledge to Wales. Well, he's taken it all over the country. He's taken it to Ireland and Scotland. He was up at the Faslane base this week, and here he is in Wales.
We're not aiming for a no-deal Brexit, and we don't think that's where we'll end up. This is very much up to our friends and partners across the Channel. They know that three times the House of Commons has thrown out that backstop. There's no way that we can get it through. We have to have that backstop out of the deal. We cannot go on with the withdrawal agreement as it currently is, and everybody understands that. It's dead. We need to get that message across to our friends. If they understand that, then I think we're going to be at the races. If they can't compromise, if they really can't do it, then clearly we have to get ready for a no-deal exit. And I think we'll do it. I think that the people of this country are full of resolve and purpose, and we will look after the farming sector. We're willing to make absolutely clear what is the case, that the UK, under no circumstances, will have checks at the border in Northern Ireland. We will throw all our energies into sorting out the problems of frictionless trade at the border. We can do it. We have all the sorts of technological solutions that are necessary to do it. But let's solve those issues in the context of the free trade agreement that we're going to do after we come out on October the 31st. That's what we want to do.
So it all seems to be coming back once more to the good old backstop and the Northern Ireland border.
We have met with Boris Johnson. We've had a fairly extensive conversation with him in which we have raised the issue of Brexit, his course of action, which seems to us to indicate that he has set the compass for a disorderly and a crash Brexit. We've challenged him very strongly on that policy. We've set out very clearly that this would be catastrophic for the Irish economy, for Irish livelihoods, for our society, for our politics, and for our peace accord. We've made it clear to him that the extensive planning that he tells us he is carrying out in respect of a potential crash Brexit has to include the constitutional question and the issue of a border poll here in Ireland. We've stated to him very clearly that Brexit in any event, but certainly a disorderly Brexit, represents, in anybody's language, a dramatic change of circumstances on this island, and that it would be unthinkable in those circumstances that people would not be given the opportunity to decide on our future together.
Sinn Féin have been calling for a referendum on the border if there is, looks like there will be a no deal. As Nigel Farage pointed out on his LBC programme.
So it's been a big, big day for Mary Lou McDonald. She's really kind of put Boris Johnson a bit on the back foot, demanding a border poll if we leave with no deal. Do you think that poll's going to be called?
No, I don't. But if it were to be called, I think that the people in the north of Ireland would vote against it. You have a large number of people in places like North Down who thought Remain in the Brexit vote was the right thing to do. But when it comes down to the crucial thing, the thing which is of paramount importance to the unionist people in Northern Ireland, Labour people, other people who want to remain a part of the UK, they would vote decisively to stay in the United Kingdom. That's more important to the people in Northern Ireland than virtually anything else.
Well, I mean, all of these things are coming to a head, aren't they? It may be that there is no deal, in which case there'll be no border poll. There may be a border poll in which either side might win. if the DUP weren't propping up the Tory government, then, and as you saw, the Tory membership said that they'd rather have a united Ireland provided they could have Brexit. But we're all in this position because the Tories are being propped up by the DUP, who are a minority party in Northern Ireland. They don't have majority support.
But only by one now.
Yeah, that's right. Sinn Féin were 1,000 votes behind them last time. And of course, if there's another poll under PR, well, they're going to end up potentially having the Prime Minister's job.
The Wales by-election, don't you think, Tony Carey, don't you think maybe that the pro-Brexit side should have done an electoral pact deal like the Remainers did in Radnorshire, because they said, well, we're just going to have one candidate from the Greens are not going to stand, and only one Remainer candidate, and they won because the Brexit vote was split between the Brexit Party and the Tories.
I think that was absolute common sense how they played that game, and we were talking about that before the programme, that the Brexit vote was split in many ways. You had the Brexit Party itself. You had the Conservative Party. You had Plaid Cymru didn't stand. No, they didn't stand, did they? But
because they're Remainers, they didn't stand. Neither did the Greens. Only the Lib Dems. So that was electoral pact.
It was. And that's I'm not against that. If that's the way, you know, you can play that legally, then it's just a game, and off you go, and you play to those rules. And basically, the Conservatives or whomsoever is in power after the next general election, they'll have to learn that trick.
The big question is, can Boris push through a no deal on one vote?
No,
majority?
Not a chance.
Martin?
I think that's right. Not a chance.
What will happen?
Well, eventually there's going to be a vote of confidence in the government as we get closer and closer. And, of course, the economy is now weakening massively. So there's no reason why the left of the Tory party are going to tolerate a no-deal Brexit. They're not. It just takes one Tory to defect to the Lib Dems. And I understand people are thinking of doing that, and the majority of the government is gone. And then it's a general election, isn't it?
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Well, I still think the success or otherwise of Brexit, no deal or any old way, is going to depend largely on what the Bank of England governor does. And he was interviewed this morning on the Today programme, Radio 4, where John Humphreys, who, by the way, I thought was supposed to be leaving. I mean, he announced it last year, was it, at the beginning of this year, that he was going to retire, but he's still going strong, talked to Mark Carney about the idea of if there is a no deal, and it all starts to go pear-shaped here in Britain with the economy, that he'll start propping it up and do a kind of New Deal-style Roosevelt, spend loads and loads of money to get the economy going. A stimulus.
Should the bank be prepared to cut interest rates and effectively endorse a massive stimulus if there is no deal?
Yeah, what we have said is that the response to no deal will not be automatic. It will depend on what happens, not just to the supply of the economy. So what we were just talking about, the plants, etc., which ones keep running and which ones have to shut down and there'll be an adjustment. But what happens to the exchange rate? What happens to demand? We will do everything we can in order to provide support to the economy. We have to recognize that in general, no deal will be inflationary for the economy.
It will be the wrong way to go.
Well, we will do what we post referendum. We faced a similar situation, not exactly the same situation. Post referendum, and we expected this was what was going to happen. Was that the pound went down? That's inflationary, and that we felt that it was appropriate to look through that bit of inflation to make sure that the adjustment was not taken in jobs, but was taken in a bit of inflation. Now, there are limits to our ability to do that. The big, big difference in the event of no deal from a referendum is that with no deal, the shock to the economy is instantaneous, and that instantly you have these supply not just disruptions, so I'm not talking about just the issues at the ports, which are real, but you actually have businesses that no longer are economic. Potentially, it's a substantial number, and that has to be taken into account.
Instantaneous no-deal shock, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's basically laying it out. There will be a shock. If there's no deal, there'll definitely be a shock. There could be the speculators could push a big run on the pound. Then you have to raise interest rates.
Is George Soros rubbing his hands, you think?
It's not George Soros is just one of the speculators. The real speculators are like Odie and Redwood.
And what about
and all these other people
Philip
who are pro-Brexit? They're advising their clients to sell the pound.
What about Theresa May's husband, Philip May?
Lots of the people who are pushing Brexit are hedge fund managers, and they're advising their people. John Redwood's admitted this, that they might as well bet against the pound because it's a one-way bet.
But the thing about these managers is they're not necessarily on one side or the other. They just see this as a money-making opportunity.
Well, indeed.
Tony, what do you make of Mark Carney's attitude here?
Well, I never liked the bloke anyway. I couldn't see why we needed to import a foreigner, for damn sake, and run the Bank of England. I don't think the guy is giving us the best attention to detail on the Brexit issue.
We heard he's part of this group of 30 over in Washington who are the executive committee that run global capitalism. So maybe he's got more interest in that little group than he is in the British economy. Anyway,
yeah.
Before we finish, £250,000 has been spent on cleaning up the bear pit. And here is from the Circle Group, Miriam Delglu, who was one of the people who was involved in the bear pit improvement group. But then they pulled out, and then the council pulled the rug out from underneath the Bear Pit Improvement Group, and things went downhill from there on at the end of last year. So let's have a listen to her now, who was on Radio Bristol earlier this week.
I got involved in the Bear Pit in 2012, and it was just at the time the Bear Pit Improvement Group had started. Well, to me, it's always been sort of a space where, you know, it's always been like an oasis. It's hidden away from the traffic. It had lots of greenery, and it was one of the few places where you didn't have to worry about cars. So it was worth fighting for something to be really great, really.
Now, just to point out, we don't know when, because we said about your contents being destroyed in there and over £14,000 worth of kitchen equipment stolen, but we're not saying that happened over the weekend. We don't know at what point that happened, do we?
Yeah, so that's basically the aftermath from after the squat happened. Mm. We stopped trading in November when drug use in the space increased. It was no longer safe for us to be down there. There was, you know, serious lack of police, lack of cleaning, and it was an inhospitable place. The squat happened, I believe, just before Christmas, and so then we weren't able to get to any of our things.
That's Miriam there from the Circle Group. Also problems with lack of public toilets. And it seems to me there's a little bit of an attempt to blame the squatters for all this stuff, whereas actually the police should have been in there, Tony, arresting some of these spice dealers who were dealing openly in the bear pit.
That was ridiculous, how the bear pit was allowed to descend into total anarchy. The bear pit, to my way of thinking, had a future. It has a future. It could be the most wonderful community space, but it still has to be somehow or other policed, whether it's policed by the Avon and Somerset Constabulary or whether it is policed by the people themselves. Somewhere along the line, that is a very valuable space in Bristol, and we must make use of it.
Martin, the Bristol Post's headline saying the squatters stole the BBC, squatters stole £14,000 worth of kitchen equipment. Well, actually, the squatters didn't steal it, they were actually using it. It was stolen by the spice heads, and it was stolen possibly even by security. Anyway, sorry, that's the time for the news. Thanks to our guests, independent councillor, ex-conservative from Bristol to the East, Tony Carey. Join us after the US Own Comcast News at 7 when we take a look around the world.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.